Good afternoon. I am Chelsea Brennigan, a tax policy specialist with the Interpretations and Technical Advice Division of the Department of Revenue. I will be the facilitator for this public hearing. It is currently 2:02 p.m. on Tuesday, October 25th, 2022. We'd like to thank you for taking the time to attend this public hearing and to provide us with your feedback. Please note that we are best able to consider your comments if you provide them to us in writing, which can be sent to me at chelseab@dor.wa.gov. We will now begin the scheduled public hearing for solicitation of comments on the new rule WAC 458-20-285, or Rule 285, titled Working Families Tax Credit. Other persons present for this hearing include Atif Aziz in his role as the department's rules coordinator, Sierra Crumbaker in her role as our management analyst for the Interpretations and Technical Advice Division, who will be monitoring our recording equipment this afternoon as this meeting is being recorded. Kevin Dixon, who is the Assistant Director of the Working Families Tax Credit Division. Andy Van Gerpen, who is the Program Manager of the Working Families Tax Credit Division. Katie Kuntz, who is the Program Coordinator of the Tax Credit Administration Unit of the Working Families Tax Credit Division, and Tim Jenrich, who is the Assistant Director of the Interpretations and Technical Advice Division. We are conducting this meeting electronically, and we do not have other parties physically present for this public hearing. It does seem as though we do have some other Department of Revenue staff who are attending this public hearing, so I will briefly go through and say their names for the record. If I do miss you, just please feel free to speak up. We have Perla Gamboa on the call. We have Therese Conchu. We have Brenton Madison, and I believe that may be it for additional Department of Revenue staff. If I did not call your name, let me know now. All right. So now, besides Department of Revenue staff, we do have other parties on the call for this public hearing. Due to the rulemaking requirements, participants at the public hearing who have comments must make their comments verbally. As such, we will not be reviewing questions or comments provided in the chat function for this hearing. If you do not feel comfortable voicing your comments during this hearing, we suggest that you email your comments to me in writing at chelseab@dor.wa.gov. Additionally, as noted on the slide, you do have the option to turn on the live captions feature by going to the More option at the top right of your screen and clicking on the three dots. And then if you scroll down the list, you can click on the Turn on live captions option. Next slide. So I will now read down the list of participants, and when you are called, please go off mute, and for the record, please state your name, and if you are representing someone, please state who you are representing and whether you have comments that you would like to make later in this public hearing. So we will start with Aaron, I'm sorry in advance, Sizweski.
My name is Aaron Chizeski. I'm with Food Lifeline. And if it's possible, I'd like to reserve a determination about making comments until a later time.
Sure, that's fine. Amanda Kim.
Hello, my name is Amanda Kim. I am a Working Families Tax Credit Coalition member. I work for Balance Our Tax Code, and I do have a public comment for later in the afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Adele Ramirez?
Hello, yes, thank you. My name is Adele Ramirez, and I work for One America in Yakima, Washington. My organization is part of the coalition that advocates for working families tax credit. And first of all, I want to start off by thanking the Department of Revenue for removing the requirements that applicants include a copy of their government-issued photo ID and having to list all of their addresses in order to prove residency. But my comment today is regarding the applicants using ITIN to apply when requesting the credit. This is a very limited pool of applicants, and we feel that there's no reason to hold up their process while waiting for the IRS, who has a backlog of ITIN numbers that have not been issued yet, in order for them to receive this credit. The one main reason that we would like to see this changed is because we would not want this holdup in process to deter families from applying in subsequent years for the assistance and for this credit. So I would wish you all to consider that greatly, and that's the end of my comment.
Thank you, Adele. We will be going through specifically some of the substantive changes that were made, the change to the ITIN process being one of them, but we will keep your comment in mind. Looks like we have someone else coming in. April M. April, it looks like you just joined us, but right now we're just introducing ourselves for the record. So if you could please provide your name, who you are representing, if you are representing anybody, and if you plan to make comments during this public hearing.
Hi, my name is April Matsui, and I'm representing PIM Savvy, and we are doing outreach for the Working Families Tax Credit. So I'm just here to listen and learn.
Thank you. Diane Boschweiler?
Yes, my name is Diane Boschweiler with H&R Block. I do not plan to make comments. I'm here to learn as well.
Thank you. Casey Lance.
Hello, my name is Casey Lance. I'm part of the Working Family Tax Credit Coalition, and I'm representing United Way of King County. At this time, I do not plan to make any comments, but I will be submitting a written letter from the rest of my organization.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Cheryl Williams. Cheryl, if you wouldn't mind going off mute and introducing yourself for the record. Okay, Cheryl may be having some technical problems. So we'll move on to Christina.
Hi, good afternoon. Christina Wong, she, her pronouns with Northwest Harvest. And I have to leave early, so I'm listening in, but plan on submitting written comments.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Colin.
Good afternoon, Colin Thrower, policy analyst with SDM Consulting. However, I do not intend to make comments.
Right. Thank you for that. Diana.
Hi, this is Diana Salazar, she, her pronouns, from SEIU 775, and I do plan on making comments.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Emily.
Hi, y'all. Emily Vananik. I'm from the Washington State Budget and Policy Center representing the Working Family Tax Credit Coalition. and I do plan on making comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Melissa.
Melissa Gorham, I am here in the capacity as a district general manager for Central Washington, specifically Yakima, at H&R Block. I will not be making any public comments. I'm just here to learn.
Great. Thank you so much. James.
Yeah, James Hartvigson from TaxHawk. I do not plan to make any comments.
Great. Thank you so much. Joseph.
Hi, this is Joseph Shoji Lockman with Policy Manager, Asian Counseling and Referral Service, also part of the Working Families Tax Credit Coalition. And I will be making comment during the public hearing. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Katie.
Hi, everyone. Katie Dong. I am the Policy Manager at Children's Alliance and part of the Working Families Tax Credit Coalition. I do not plan on making comments during this time. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Katrina.
Katrina Kaler Wilson. I'm with Community Action Council and I plan on not making comment.
All right. Thank you so much. Kenda.
This is Kenda Christian and I'm just here to learn.
All right. Thank you so much. Leela.
Hi, everyone. This is Leela Reynolds with the Washington State Budget and Policy Center, also representing the Working Families Tax Credit Coalition. And I do plan on making comments.
Great. Thank you so much. So, Leela, it looks like you just came in. Right now, we are introducing ourselves for the record. So if you could please state your name, who you are representing, if you're representing anyone, and then if you plan to make any comments during this public hearing.
Hello, it's Don Cook, Community Care Northwest, Community Center up here in Bellingham, and not planning on making any comments.
Great, thank you so much. Maggie.
Good afternoon, Maggie Humphreys with the Working Families Tax Credit Coalition. I work for Moms Rising, and I do plan on making comments today.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Matthew.
Hello, my name is Matthew Shalady. I'm with Spokane County United Way, and I do not plan on making any comments.
Right. Thank you for that. Wren.
Hi, this is Edgar Kalka with Wren Wilkes in Vancouver, and we're part of the group that's doing outreach for the credit and do not plan on making comments at this time.
Okay. Thank you for that. Sunite.
Hi, this is Sunite Zahlai from Northwest Harvest. I do not plan on making comments during this public hearing. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for that. Shane.
Shane Magdoff, and I guess I'm representing AARP here in Eastern Washington. And I'm listening and learning since I'm going to have to process these credits.
All right. Thank you so much. Tracy.
Hello, Tracy Underwood with the Economic Opportunity Institute and a member of the Working Families Tax Credit Coalition. And I do not plan to make comments today.
Great. Thanks so much. And if you're not speaking, if you wouldn't mind just putting your microphone on mute, that would be very helpful. Thank you so much. Veronica. Veronica Rodriguez. All right. Veronica might be having some technical issues, so we will go to Will.
Hi, everyone. This is Will Von Gelder, and I represent Ventures Nonprofit and the Working Families Tax Credit Coalition. I won't be making comments, but do just want to support all the comments of my other coalition mates. Thanks.
Perfect. Thanks so much. So I know we did have a few people trickling in. If I missed you, if you wouldn't mind raising your hand, so then we can get your name for the record, that would be very helpful. So I'll just pause here for a quick second just to make sure that we have everybody. All right, not seeing any hand raised. So let's move on. Next slide, please. All right, so this public hearing is being conducted pursuant to the provisions of Chapter 34.05 RCW, the Administrative Procedure Act. The purpose of this hearing is to solicit comments from the public on the proposed Rule 285. This hearing was announced through publication in the State Register as WSR 22-19-085, which was filed with the code reviser on September 20th, 2022. The rule, as proposed, is written in the legislative drafting style. In going through this proposed rule draft, if you do plan to provide comments, please wait until comments are requested before providing them. If you do have a comment, please use the raised hand feature, which is located under the reactions icon at the top right of your screen. When your name is called, please unmute yourself using the mic icon, identify yourself for the record, and provide your comment. When you are finished, please put yourself back on mute. We will consider any and all comments received about the proposed rule. We appreciate receiving written comments, and we will evaluate all comments as we proceed with the rulemaking process. You may send written comments to my attention no later than Friday, October 28th. In this manner, the department can fully consider your comments before proceeding with future rulemaking activities. Right, next slide, please. So this public hearing will address the substantive changes that were made to the proposed rule since the previous public hearing in June. Please note that other non-substantive changes were also made to the rule, but we will not be discussing them in detail here. Non-substantive changes include grammatical updates and revisions, along with minor word changes and clarifications which do not impact the substantive meaning of the rule. Examples of non-substantive changes that were made include, but are not limited to, capitalization of letters or changing letters to lowercase, the removal of commas or extra spaces, and the addition of missing words or the removal of extraneous words. If you would like a complete list of the non-substantive changes that were made, these can be provided to you upon request. Please note that we have included some sections that were updated in the rule so that you may see exactly what changes were made. Added words are underlined, and deleted or removed words will have a strike through, as indicated on the slide. For smaller changes, I will also be reading how the proposed rule draft currently reads to give you an understanding of how these changes impacted the rule. The proposed rule draft is divided into four parts with several numbered sections within those parts. I will go through the changes that were made throughout the proposed draft and then state the reason for the change. At the end of each slide, I will pause for comments before moving on to the next slide. In most cases, this is not a direct reading of the rule, so I urge you to please also read the rule itself, as the content in the slides is only meant to provide a general summary, and what is in the slides does not necessarily reflect the language used in the rule itself. Copies of this rule are available on our website, and we have also included a link in the chat if you did not receive a copy, or if you would like to have an additional one for reference during this public hearing. We will be starting on page 5 of the most recently filed CR 102. Next slide. All right, we'll be starting under part one, which discusses eligibility requirements. Next slide. Specifically, we will be starting with the changes made to section 1D, which again discusses residency. So this section was updated to clarify that the primary applicant on the working families application must meet the residency requirement. So the reason for this change is merely to clarify that the primary applicant must fulfill the residency requirement, but please note that either spouse may be the primary applicant if they are filing under the married filing jointly status. Additionally, too, we have a non-substantive change here, but the word for was added in describing the number of days required for residency. The reason for this change was just for grammar and for clarity. So you can see here that the section now reads, the primary applicant on the working families application, which may be either you or your spouse if you are filing married filing jointly on your federal income tax return, must be a resident of Washington for at least 183 days during the tax year for which the refund is being claimed. So you can see here that the added words are underlined. So before moving on, are there any comments on what was shared on this slide? If you do wish to make a comment, we ask that you please identify yourself for the record prior to doing so. Okay, hearing none, let's move on to the next slide. So these changes were under question 2B, which discusses what is a valid I-10. So this was the first change of three that were made. So this change, you can find it in answer 2B in the first paragraph in the second sentence. And here the department clarified that a valid I-10 also cannot be one that is revoked. So the reason for this change is to align the term with the IRS requirements for what constitutes a valid I-10. Before going into this a bit further, just as a bit of background regarding the updates that were made to answer 2B generally, again, you can see this is just one of three. The comments received from the previous public hearing in June prompted the department to revisit the meaning of what is a valid I-10. In its analysis, the department found that a valid I-10 is one that is current, meaning that it is not expired or revoked. Additionally, in the department's communications with the IRS, the IRS also confirmed that they do not consider I-10s to have been applied for or reapplied for, but are not yet issued, to be valid. Considering this, the department interprets the term valid to mean current, meaning that the I-10 cannot be expired or revoked in order for the department to issue the applicant their working families refund. So with this change here, the sentence now reads, a valid I-10 for working families eligibility purposes is one that is not expired or revoked. And I do ask for the person who just called in, if you could please put yourself on mute, that would be very helpful. But I actually do see that you haven't provided your name for the record. If you wouldn't mind providing your name and any organization that you work for, if you have one, if you plan to make comments at this public hearing, that would be very helpful and appreciated. The phone number is 206-696-5501. So if you're calling in on that number, if you could please provide that.
I'm on an iPhone and I'm not sure how to do that. I'm going to put myself back on mute.
Okay. If you actually wouldn't mind just saying your name for the record, and if you have any comments, that would be very helpful for this public hearing. Okay.
My name is David.
All right. Thank you, David.
Sure.
Okay. So with the changes that were made here on what constitutes a valid ITIN, and again, for reference, the department included that a valid ITIN is one that is not expired or revoked. Asking for comments on what was shared on this slide. If you do wish to make a comment, we ask that you please identify yourself for the record prior to doing so.
Would this be a good, this is Adele Ramirez, would this be a good point for me to do my comment, or is it on the record already?
Adele, if you would like to make your comment, you may do so again here if you would like.
Sure, thank you. So again, first of all, I want to thank the Department of Revenue for removing the requirement that applicants include a copy of the government issued photo ID and not having to list all of their previous addresses to approve residency. So my comment again goes to this very thing about folks who are applying with ITINs and who would be requesting it from the IRS. The IRS currently has roughly a 3-month backlog on issuing those ITIN numbers. Hopefully as we go forward, that will be resolved and maybe will be a smoother process. But we feel that holding up the refund on the on folks who have ITINs or who are filing with an ITIN or a requested ITIN does hold up the process and could cause down the road families not to participate in this program in subsequent years. So thank you.
Great, thank you for that. Any other comments? Shane, I see your hand is raised.
And this is more of a question. I understand the comment that was just made. It sounds like some people will just be doing the Working Families Tax Credit form. We'll be using it in conjunction with the federal taxes that we'll be preparing for them. And they do need a picture ID for that. So I don't know if that's a conflict or what.
To clarify your question, you're asking if it would be a conflict if the federal income tax return requires a photo ID, but the Working Families Tax Credit application does not require a photo ID, if this would be a conflict.
Okay, so this is just the application for it.
Correct, yes.
Okay. Yes, that was my question.
Yes. So the Working Families Tax Credit application no longer requires participants or applicants to provide their photo identification.
Okay, I got it. Thanks.
Yeah. All right, any other comments as to what was provided on this slide? All right, hearing none, let's move on to the next slide. Oh, so sorry, Maggie, did you have a question on the previous, did you have a comment to make on the previous slide?
I did, but now seeing this next slide, actually, it'll fit here too. So please feel free to move on and I'll comment afterward. Thank you.
Perfect. Okay, thank you so much. All right, so this next change, again, is under answer 2B. In the second paragraph, in the second sentence. So these changes just provide that the applicants must notify the department if they have applied for and are waiting to receive an ITIN or an ITIN renewal, rather than providing proof that they have done so. So the reason for this change is that it clarifies expectations and requirements for applicants. The sentence now reads, if you, your spouse, or any of your qualifying children do not have a valid ITIN and are waiting for an ITIN or an ITIN renewal from the IRS, you must notify the department that you have applied for and are waiting to receive an ITIN or an ITIN renewal from the IRS when you submit your working families application. All right, so before moving on, are there any comments on what was shared on this slide? If you do wish to make a comment, we ask that you please identify yourself for the record prior to doing so. Again, please note that we will not be using the chat function for the purposes of this public hearing. So if you do have a comment, please, you do need to state it verbally, or you can send me a written comment after this public hearing as well. But I'm not hearing any comments on this slide. So let's move on to the next one.
Hi, Chelsea. Oh. This is Lila Reynolds. I have more of a question.
Sure.
It says you must notify the department that you have applied for and are waiting to receive an ITIN or an ITIN renewal. Mm-hmm. Is there a way that the department is requesting that folks do that, considering that, as far as I know, on the application, there is no place to check I'm waiting to renew my ITIN?
Yes, thank you. So it's my understanding that the application does now have a check mark where applicants can check if they are waiting for the IRS to provide them with a new or renewed ITIN. And this is simply to allow this information to become a part of our internal data and records. So to answer your question, it would be on the application, is my understanding.
Thank you.
All right. I see Diana. You have your hand raised.
Hi. Yeah, this is Diana. I also have a question. Will there be an option for folks to state what language they would like letters from Department of Revenue to receive, for example, notifications on their ITIN or status of their ITIN application? In a different language other than English?
Just to make sure that I'm understanding your question, is there a method for individuals to request that they have an application in their language of choice? Is that your question?
No, I'm asking what is there an option to document what language they would like to get written communication from the Department of Revenue?
Ah, okay. All right. I'm not entirely sure about the processes for that, but it's a very good question. Actually, if you wouldn't mind just sending that to me in writing, I can take a little bit of a better look at that and our internal procedures on that, and I can get back to you on that. All right. Okay. Any additional comments or questions on this slide? Just hold here for a minute or two. All right, hearing none, let's go to the next slide. All right, so this is again answer 2B. This is the second paragraph starting with the third sentence. So here the department clarified and updated the procedures for applicants awaiting IRS approval for their new and renewed ITINs. So here, just generally, the department included additional procedures, just noting that applicants must submit their completed working families application on or before the December 31st due date, even if the IRS has not fully processed their request for a new or renewed ITIN. Additionally, the department will consider a new or renewed ITIN as valid as of the IRS issuance date, as long as this issuance date is before the December 31st due date, even if notification of this issuance is received after the working families application deadline. So for new IATINs, this means that the IRS issuance date is the date that the form W-7 was received by the IRS. And then for renewed ITINs, the IRS issuance date is the date the original ITIN was issued. So I also have a brief example here to help put this into context a bit better. So for example, an applicant submits their completed working families application and files their federal income tax return for the 2022 tax year on November 1st, 2023, but has requested a new ITIN from the IRS. So the IRS receives the applicant's federal income tax return and Form W-7 on November 15th, 2023, and approves the applicant's request for a new ITIN on February 1st, 2024. The applicant then notifies the department of the IRS's approval on February 15th, 2024. Because the issuance date of the applicant's new ITIN will be the date the Form W-7 was received by the IRS, or in this case, that's November 15th, 2023, the department will consider November 15th, 2023 to be the date that the ITIN was valid, despite having received notification of this approval after the working families application deadline had passed. So the reason for this change was to clarify the department's procedures for processing working families applications for those with ITINs. So before moving on, are there any comments on what was shared on this slide? If you do wish to make a comment, we ask that you please identify yourself for the record prior to doing so. Emily, I see that you have your hand raised.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to, I know the department's worked hard to make some key changes and ensuring that the issuance date is backdated to when the application was received. Really do urge the department to consider processing the ITIN filer application for the Working Families Tax Credit once the application is received. Recognizing that it can be a really arduous and difficult process for someone to have to resubmit an amended application, and that a lot of folks are really dependent on this cash payment. So we just urge the department to process those applications from ITIN filers without delay, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Emily. Thank you for your comment. Maggie, I see that you have a comment as well.
Thank you. I echo Emily's appreciation for some of the changes that have been made, but also urge the department to adopt an application process for ITIN filers that is low barrier and accessible, and to accept the application at the time of the ITIN application. This process will delay life-saving cash to families across the state, and it creates a burden on families to have to follow up and provide additional labor in order to receive this cash payment that they're entitled to. And so we urge the department to accept the application when the ITIN application is made.
All right. Thank you. Abigail, I see your hand raised.
Hi, for the record, this is Abigail Leong with Fuse Washington. I'd like to echo the thanks of the last two folks who testified and also their point that we would love the department to considering an ITIN received and valid when the ITIN application is made and not when they have received word back that their ITIN is processed. We know these people are working hard, they're paying taxes, and it shouldn't be, it's not their fault that there's often long delays when they're trying to get their ITIN back. It also would save the department a lot of work trying to follow up with people, and we don't want anyone to lose out on their credit because the department's having a hard time reaching them, or
because the delays are falling on a date that would make it impossible for them to get the credit at the time that they receive their tax information. So I urge the Department of Revenue to considering an ITIN valid when the application is received. Thank you.
Great, thank you. I think Joseph, I see your hand raised as well.
Hi, this is Joseph Lockman again with Asian Counseling and Referral Service and the WFTC Coalition. In line with other members of our coalition, again, is urging that the Department of Revenue adopt a process for ITIN filers that keeps equity in mind and reduces barriers as much as possible, especially with the idea of accepting applications that accepting the Working Families Tax Credit application at the time of the ITIN application. Just really thinking this as an equity issue and not putting an extra barrier for families who are struggling the most. And again, also reducing the burden on the department as well as the applicants in this process. And again, not withholding potentially life-saving payments to families because of bureaucratic issues that are out of their control. Thank you.
Okay, I just want to make sure, Abigail, you didn't have any additional comments or questions.
Nope, sorry.
Okay, all right. Great, okay, Lila.
Hi everyone, for the record, my name is Lila Reynolds, and I'm representing the Washington State Budget and Policy Center and the Working Families Tax Credit Coalition. And I just want to echo my friends and colleagues and say that creating a low barrier application process for ITIN filers is a racial justice and equity issue. And as it stands, there's currently a huge amount of barriers in this process for ITIN filers, starting from when they have to, apply for an ITIN. There's a high likelihood that they'll be charged extra by tax preparers just for filling out that Form W-7. There's a high likelihood that lots of folks will get taken advantage of through this process that has been designed, the process that means that they have to go back to the Department of Revenue multiple times to provide proof of what is essentially a rubber stamp from the IRS accepting their application. And it's extremely confusing. So you have one process for folks who have a Social Security number that is, pretty good. I am super happy about some of the changes the Department of Revenue has made. And then you have a second process for ITIN filers that creates a lot of extra barriers for those folks who are already facing barriers and don't receive a lot of the same tax credits that taxpayers who file with Social Security numbers receive. So for ITIN filers, this tax credit is super important. It's a benefit that they are eligible for. And I would urge the Department of Revenue to process folks' applications right when they're received rather than delaying them and requiring them to follow up with the department. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Deanna.
Hi, for the record, this is Deanna from SEIU 775, also part of the Working Families Tax Credit Coalition. Really want to echo what everyone else has already said, agree with everything around racial justice and an equity issue. We've been advocating for this since day one, so we really hope that DOR is able to, process their ITIN as when it's received and fully processed and not create additional steps. I think one other topic that we really haven't talked about is the more steps and the more hurdles we create for folks to access this, the more opportunities for them to get frauded. We know that there's going to be potential external partners that are going to try to take advantage of ITIN filers and try to charge them and say, hey, let me help with this additional step of notifying DOR that you now have your ITIN. And that's something that we definitely want to put on your radar. And one way to get rid of that is just to make this as easy and as accessible as possible. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Deanna. Pause here for any additional comments on what was presented on this slide. All right, hearing none, let's go to the next slide. All right, so this next change takes place under question 4E, which asks, are there any other federal earned income tax requirements that could potentially disqualify me from receiving the Working Families Tax Credit? So under the answer to 4E, the department updated the $10,000 investment income limit for that was in place for 2021 to $10,300 to reflect the investment income limit changes for the 2022 tax year. And again, this reason for this change was just to update these numbers to reflect the 2022 tax year figures in an attempt to better promote accuracy when preparing the Working Families application. So before moving on, are there any comments on what was shared on this slide? Again, if you do wish to make a comment, we ask that you please identify yourself for the record prior to doing so. All right, hearing none, let's move on to the next slide. All right, so under question 5D, what if my spouse is not a Washington resident, but I am, and we file under the married filing jointly status on our federal income tax return? Are we eligible for the Working Families Tax Credit refund? This section was generally updated to clarify again that the primary applicant on the Working Families application must be the one to meet the residency requirement. So the reason for this change was, as we noted previously, to clarify that the primary applicant must fulfill the residency requirements. But again, either spouse may be the primary applicant if they are filing under the married filing jointly status. So the section now reads, yes, if you and your spouse are filing married filing jointly on your federal income tax return and your spouse does not meet the definition of a Washington resident, you may both still qualify to receive a joint refund so long as the primary applicant on the Working Families application meets the definition of a Washington resident. So before moving on, are there any comments on what was shared on this slide? If you do wish to make a comment, we ask that you please identify yourself for the record prior to doing so. All right, hearing none, let's move on to question 5E. So question 5E asks, what if I'm experiencing homelessness? Can I still qualify for the Working Families refund? So in answer 5E, and specifically subsection C, the department updated this section to clarify that those experiencing homelessness need only submit a letter rather than an affidavit, and that attestation is not required for this letter. So the reason for this change is just to reflect previous changes that were made to this section, but were not fully incorporated into the prior rule draft. So subsection C, which I think is the last requirement for this letter, now reads, the individual has resided in this area at least 183 days during the period for which the credit is being claimed. If an individual or their families are experiencing homelessness and move frequently as a result, the letter may state that the individual has resided within a general geographic area or areas, i.e. town, city, county, etc., within the state of Washington for at least 183 days during the period for which the refund is being claimed. So before moving on, are there any comments on what was shared on this slide? If you do wish to make a comment, we ask that you please identify yourself for the record prior to doing so. Let's move on to the next slide. All right, so now we are on part two, which describes the application process. Next slide. All right, so section 8, which asks, what additional items do I need to include for the department to process my working families application? As was alluded to earlier, the major change here was the removal of the photo identification requirement. So the reason for this change was based on the comments received in the previous public hearing. The department will no longer require a photo ID from applicants or an applicant's spouse. So updates that were made to this section, again, we did not indicate all of the language which was removed from this section, but just simply summarized that removal includes all mention of a photo identification, any documents related to a photo identification, and any requirement to include a photo identification with an applicant's working families application. So before moving on, are there any comments on what was shared on this slide? Again, if you do wish to make a comment, we ask that you please identify yourself for the record prior to doing so. Oh, Emily, so your hand is raised.
Yeah, I just wanted to say thank you for removing this barrier. It's a huge barrier that could have prevented a lot of folks from accessing this. And I think just wanted to share my appreciation for removing that.
Great. Thank you so much for that. Any other comments? All right, hearing none, let's move on to the next slide. So here you can see we did make some changes to the wording of question 8A, which now reads, what happens if I do not provide my complete federal income tax return with my working families application? So you can see here that some of the added words are underlined, and we've removed the language which required applicants to provide additional required documents to update the change in policy in which the department no longer requires a photo identification from applicants or their spouses. So again, the reason for this change is just to emphasize that the only requirement for applicants is to provide their completed federal income tax return along with their working families application. So before moving on, are there any comments on what was shared on this slide? If you do wish to make a comment, again, we ask that you please identify yourself for the record prior to doing so. All right, hearing none, let's move on to the next slide. Right, so this is question 8B, which asks, what does it mean to have a complete working families application? So under the answer 8B, the department removed the photo identification requirement and clarified that a copy of the filed federal income tax return must be submitted with the applicant's working families application. Again, the reason for this change was just to reflect the departmental policy change and to better clarify application requirements. So apologies for some of the confusion. Subsection B is not actually removed here. I was just having some issues with PowerPoint. But subsection C, which had the proof of identity requirement, has been removed. And subsection B was updated to read a copy of your complete federal income tax return that was filed with the federal government. So again, only subsections A and B are now listed. And these are the only requirements to have a complete application under the proposed rule draft. So before moving on, are there any comments on what was shared on this slide? Again, if you do wish to make a comment, we ask that you please identify yourself for the record prior to doing so. Layla, see your hand is raised.
Hi, Layla Reynolds. I just wanted to ask, Chelsea, will you be able to provide a copy of this PowerPoint after this hearing?
Yeah, I can look into that, and I can see what we can do.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other comments? All right, hearing none, let's move on to the next slide. All right, so part three, in which we discuss the refund amounts. Next slide. All right, so we made some updates under question 10D. You can see we made two updates here. The question 10D asks, what is the reduced federal income threshold and how does it affect my working family's refund amount? So in the answer to 10D, the department included the refund reduction percentages in subsections A through D that are applicable to the 2022 tax year and included a statement that was clarifying this update from the original statutory amounts. And this statement is in the paragraph just before subsection A. So the reason for this change is that it's just updating these refund reduction percentages to reflect the 2022 tax year amounts. So I do have a chart on this slide, which indicates the rates that are currently in the statute, and that's that middle column, and then the rates for the 2022 tax year that are currently in the proposed rule draft. So you can see and compare those. So before moving on, are there any comments on what was shared on this slide? If you do wish to make a comment, we ask that you please identify yourself for the record prior to doing so. All right, hearing none, let's move on to the next slide. All right, so our second change under question 10D. So this change, again, was in answer 10D, and this was the removal of the last sentence in the paragraph after subsection D, which noted that the annual adjustments for these refund reduction percentages will be published in an excise tax advisory separate from this rule. So the reason for this change was that the department updated this to better reflect the potential methods for sharing future annual adjustments. So just as a quick note on that, the department is reviewing different methods of publishing the annual updates for the refund reduction percentages and is determining which method will be preferable. However, regardless of the method chosen, the public will still have the opportunity to provide their comments before any changes take effect. So before moving on, are there any comments on what was shared on this slide? If you do wish to make a comment, we ask that you please identify yourself for the record prior to doing so. All right, hearing none, let's move on to the next slide. All right, so under question 10E, which asks, how does the department calculate my working family's tax credit refund? So the department made some adjustments to answer 10E, specifically to the figures in the tables and the examples. These were updated to reflect the 2022 tax year amounts, and this is for both the federal threshold amounts and the refund reduction percentages that we just discussed. So the reason for this change was just to provide a clearer and more accurate example of how to calculate the working family's refund for the 2022 tax year. Another change, specifically in answer 10E, in example 3, in the conclusion, this is in actually the last sentence. The department will, please note that this change hasn't actually taken effect yet, but the department will, before finalizing, we will update the calculated working families refund amount in the example from $590.64 to $591 to reflect the statutory rounding requirements for calculated working families refund amounts. So the reason for this change is to provide a clearer understanding of how the department will calculate the working families refund amounts. So the sentence will be updated to read, John and Mary's working families refund amount is $590.64, which will be rounded up to $591. So before moving on, are there any comments on what was shared on this slide? If you do wish to make a comment, we ask that you please identify yourself for the record prior to doing so. Shane, I see your hand is up. Shane, if you would like to share your comment.
I didn't have the mute undone. Anyway, I see where they're rounding up. Are they also going to round down if it's less than 50 cents, or everything's going to be on the upside?
Yes. So my understanding is that everything above 50 cents will be, because the statute requires that you round to the nearest dollar. Okay. You're correct. The amounts that are above 50 cents will be rounded up, and the amounts that are below 50 cents will be rounded down.
Okay.
But everybody will receive, so long as they qualify, the minimum refund amount will still be $50.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Any other comments? And Shane, if you wouldn't mind putting yourself back on mute. Perfect. Thank you so much. Any other comments on what was presented on this slide? All right, hearing none, let's move on to the next slide. All right, so question 10G. So again, this is another example of something that hasn't been changed in the rule yet, but is something that the department will change before the rule is finalized. So in question 10G, which asks, how do I determine whether a person is a qualifying child? The department plans to make some updates to answer 10G, specifically subsection D, little I 2. Before the rule is finalized, again, the department will update the language in the subsection to clarify that individuals who are not yet 24 may be a qualifying child. And so the reason for this change, the current language states that no older than 24 seems to imply that the child may be 24 years of age and still qualify, but the requirement is that they must be under 24 years of age. So this will be updated to just better clarify those requirements. So you can see the intended updates to subsection D here, that the child must be younger than you and your spouse if you are filing jointly on your federal income tax return, and under 2i, is a student who is not yet 24 years old at the end of the year for which you are claiming the refund. So before moving on, are there any comments on what was shared on this slide? If you do wish to make a comment, again, we ask that you please identify yourself for the record prior to doing so. All right, hearing none, let's move on to the next slide. Okay, next change was under question 10K, which asks, will the working family refunds be adjusted for inflation? So this also involved the removal of the sentence in the second paragraph, which notes that annual adjustments will be published in an excise tax advisory. So again, this was updated to better reflect potential methods for sharing future annual adjustments to the inflationary amounts. So as we kind of discussed before, again, for this, the department is reviewing different methods of publishing the annual updates for these amounts, and is in the process of determining which method will be preferable. However, as we discussed before, regardless of the method chosen, the department will still have the opportunity to provide their comments before the changes take effect. So before moving on, are there any comments on what was shared on this slide? If you do wish to make a comment, we ask again that you please identify yourself for the record prior to doing so. All right, hearing none, let's move on to the next slide. Okay, next change was under question 11C, which asks, how long do I have to amend my working families application? And in the and under the answer to 11C, you can see that the department added a bracket underneath the chart to indicate the years during which applicants may amend their timely filed working families application. The reason for this change was to just better indicate the amendment period, as we learned that shading was not possible. So it was not possible to shade the years that were applicable. So again, you can see the chart here. And that chart now shows that's what appears in the proposed rule draft as of right now. So before moving on, are there any comments on what was shared on this slide? Again, if you do wish to make a comment, please identify yourself for the record prior to doing so. All right, hearing none, let's move on to the next slide. All right, so now we are in part four, which just goes over general administration and review. Next slide. All right, so under question 13A, which asks, for what types of issues may I seek informal review? Under answer 13A, specifically subsection C, the department removed the term adverse in describing letter rulings. So the reason for this change was to just clarify that a letter ruling need not necessarily be adverse for a working families applicant to seek informal review of that decision. So that subsection now reads, just, you have received a letter ruling from the department. I also wanted to note another non-substantive change here, but this is again a change that has not yet been put into effect and is one that the department will include before finalizing. In answer 13A, in the paragraph after subsection C, the department will just remove the word here from the end of this sentence. So just the sentence now reads, you may find additional updates regarding letter rulings on the department's website. And again, this was just changed for accuracy and legal and grammatical clarity. So before moving on, are there any comments on what was shared on this slide? If you do wish to make a comment, we ask that you please identify yourself for the record prior to doing so. All right, hearing none, let's move on to the next slide. So question 13B, how do I request an informal review? So the department reworded some of the answer to 13B to clarify that applicants must petition the department regarding its decision on one of the actions listed under answer 13A. So the reason for this change was just to better clarify which departmental actions may allow an applicant to request an informal review. So this sentence now reads, All informal review requests must be submitted in writing to the department within 30 days of the date the department issues a decision on one of the actions listed under answer 13A. So before moving on, are there any comments on what was shared on this slide? If you do wish to make a comment, again, we ask that you please identify yourself for the record prior to doing so. All right, hearing none, let's move on to the next slide. So under question 14B, which asks, can the department assess penalties on working families' overpayments? So under the answer to 14B, the department added a sentence which clarifies that the timeline example only reflects when interest and penalties may be first assessed, and that this is not necessarily reflective of all potential assessment situations or circumstances. The reason for this change was, again, just to clarify what the timeline is intended to show. Notably, it's not intended or meant to show that the department will or plans to assess penalties in this order or manner. Rather, this timeline simply just shows when the department has the statutory ability to assess certain penalties and when interest may begin to accrue. So this paragraph now reads, below is an example of how interest and penalties may be assessed if you received a larger working families refund than you are entitled to receive and are required to pay the overpayment back. This example is to only demonstrate when interest and penalties may be first assessed and is not reflective of all potential assessment situations or circumstances. So before moving on, are there any comments on what was shared on this slide? If you do wish to make a comment, we ask that you please identify yourself for the record prior to doing so. Emily, I see that your hand is raised.
Yeah, thank you. I'm not sure if this is the best place to chime in here for what I'd like to say, so I just want to make sure I get my comment in. Just in general, would urge the department to only assess and collect overpayments on fraud for intentional violations. I know that this outlines the overall timeline, but in general, would encourage the department to lean towards forgiveness in situations where an overpayment's been made by an error, whether administratively or in earnest. Just recognizing the relatively low amount of payment that the tax credit is in general, and the high barrier that that would create for the recipient. So would urge the department to only assess and collect overpayments on fraud and intentional violations.
Great. Thanks, Emily. Joseph, I see that your hand is raised as well.
Hi, yes, this is Joseph Lockman again with ACRS and the WFTC Coalition. But really, again, in line with what Emily has commented, urging the department to find every possible way of reducing burdens on especially the most vulnerable community members who, again, would be most burdened by an overpayment, so the assessment of penalty or interest. Again, urging just overpayment forgiveness, especially in situations where it's not the fault of the applicant, and noting that, again, this is, you know, it's a very small amount for the department, but it can have a very undue burden, especially as an equity issue on some of the lowest income families who would be very dramatically affected by interest and penalties accruing on as a result of overpayment. So again, please find as many ways as possible to every extent possible explore avenues for forgiveness for overpayments. Thank you.
Thank you, Joseph. I see Maggie, you have your hand raised as well.
Thank you. Maggie Humphreys with Moms Rising. Echoing what's been said, we would urge the department to adopt a policy of waiving overpayments. At Moms Rising, we have worked closely with the Employment Security Department within the Paid Family and medical leave program as they designed their process for evaluating hardship that repayment of overpayments would create. That program serves a wide variety of Washington residents at different income levels, but this program is very different in that it exclusively serves low and moderate income families. So it is I think fair to interpret that for everyone receiving this credit, repayment of an overpayment that was made by error would create a hardship and a burden on a recipient. And so we would urge the department to follow We would urge the department to adopt a policy of forgiveness for overpayments made by error. In their recent decision package to the governor, the Department of Youth and Family and Child Services is proposing massively overhauling their overpayment process and actually suspending them for overpayments made to providers, recognizing the harm that those overpayment collections have had on providers and particularly BIPOC providers. So we'd urge the department to adopt a process that ensures equity within this program and doesn't create a hardship on families that are receiving this much needed cash, particularly low income families, particularly BIPOC families receiving this much needed credit. Thank you.
Thank you, Maggie. Joseph, I just want to make sure too, you didn't have anything else to add. I just see your hand raised. Okay. I see you put your hand down. Okay, Abigail.
Hi, once again, this is Abigail Leong with the Fuse Communications Hub and also with the Working Families Tax Credit Coalition. I'd like to echo the points that everyone has said so far. One of the reasons we were so passionate about passing this tax credit in the first place is for the people who often feel like they're constantly falling behind. This tax credit will help them get back on their feet or deal with an emergency cost and have a choice about how they can provide for their families. So I'd urge the department to consider the real ways that debt can really follow a person or family and kind of destroy their dreams for their future, especially for communities of color, immigrant communities, people who have experienced other forms of debt that accrues interest, like student debt or people with court debt. These types of debts can be really devastating to people. If the state chooses to forgive people who've made honest mistakes, the state can afford to do that. But if we choose to harshly punish struggling people who make honest errors, those people really can't afford that. And there will be long-lasting consequences that I believe are counter to the goals of the program. So I urge you all to consider forgiving people who make honest mistakes on a complicated application that there's bound to be some errors here and there. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Abigail. Aaron.
Yes, thank you. Aaron Chiseski, Food Lifeline Hunger Relief Organization. And in line with the previous comments made, I too would encourage the department to waive any repayment of overpayments made in error. And I'd note that I find it to be particularly troubling considering the compounded harm of both payment and interest as currently a potential. And so again, it would be my organization's desire that this that the repayment of overpayments would be waived. And thank you.
Great, thank you. Abigail, just checking, you didn't have any additional comments. Just see that your hand is still raised. Okay, great.
You.
I do want to briefly take the opportunity to address some of the comments that were raised specifically, you know, the question of whether or not the department will consider a waiver of working families overpayments, interest, or penalties. The department did recently issue a response based on the written comments received, which addressed this issue. And I'll just reiterate that response right now. The department does not have the authority to waive or dismiss amounts if they have been assessed unless there is explicit statutory authority to do so. So once an overpayment is assessed, the department has no statutory authority to provide a blanket waiver of the working family's overpayment amounts. So this also applies to any interest or penalties which may have been assessed. So because the department is an administrative agency, its authority to settle or resolve cases is based on what is provided in statute. And again, as there is no statutory authority for the department to provide a blanket waiver of these overpayment amounts or any penalties or interest that might have been assessed, the department is unable to implement this type of forgiveness that is being proposed. So I don't see any additional comments. So let's move on to our next slide. So before closing this public hearing, I will recap the rulemaking process. This has been the public hearing on the proposed Rule 285 titled Working Families Tax Credit. Based on the comments made today or received in writing, additional non-substantive changes may be made before the final revised rule is filed for adoption with the code revisor. Unlike today's public hearing, the final filing of a rule is not a public process. This filing is just a filing of the notice of adoption. So absent an emergency adoption, or unless otherwise stated, a rule becomes effective 31 days after filing for adoption. To the extent that rule changes are the result of specific statutory changes, such changes are effective on the effective date of the law change, regardless of when the rule is adopted. Thank you for participating in this public hearing. If you are not on the department's rules notification list and you did not receive a notice of today's hearing directly from the department, but you want to be kept informed of future rulemaking activities related to this rule, please provide Sierra Crumbaker with your name, mailing address, and email address. This public hearing is now adjourned. For the record, the time is now 3:25 p.m. Thank you so much, everyone.